Have you ever wanted to start anew in life? Have you ever wanted a fresh start? Perhaps some of you want to change careers, or move to a new country, or let go of some toxic relationships. Pick up some new skills maybe, explore some new hobbies, or maybe just get in shape. Do you want to start afresh? Have you ever wanted to start afresh? Now, starting afresh, it often instills within us a sense of optimism and hope. And it's generally good for emotional and psychological well-being. But anyone who has ever tried to start afresh knows that it's easier said than done. Because even if you can change the external circumstances that are making you frustrated and unhappy, unless you deal with the fundamental reasons why you are unhappy or unfulfilled in the first place, if you leave those things unaddressed, you will be unhappy sooner or later. Your fresh start will soon become stale, and the same frustrations return, and you will be back to square one. Someone put it this way: you need to get rid of the junk inside before you can be joyful outside. You need to get rid of the junk inside before you can be joyful outside. If you truly want to start afresh, if you truly want to get rid of the frustrations and the things that weigh you down, you need to deal with the fundamental reasons why you are frustrated and unhappy in the first place. Otherwise, you will be moving from job to job, from country to country, from church to church, and relationship to relationship, always looking for that fresh start, but always coming back to square one. What you need to do to have a truly fresh start is to deal with the fundamental things inside you. Not just deal with the external circumstances, although that must change, but to deal with what is going on inside of you. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we are in part two of the story of Noah. Last week, we looked at Genesis 6 and 7, and we saw how Noah was rescued from judgment. This week, we're going to see how God restores through judgment in Genesis 8 and 9. What we saw last week was this: the judgment of the flood was God's way of putting a halt to humanity's self-destructive trajectory. The world was filled with corruption and violence, and left to its own devices, humanity would have self-destruct. What God does in sending the flood is not to annihilate everything and everyone, but rather to give the world a fresh start. What God was doing was not destroying for the sake of destroying, but putting an end to the violence and the corruption so that the world could have a fresh start. He was redirecting the trajectory away from violence towards goodness and beauty. God was giving the world a fresh start. Now today in Genesis 8 and 9, we'll see that in order for the fresh start to be truly a fresh start, God has to make some very fundamental changes to this world and to its inhabitants in order for this fresh start to be truly fresh. He needs to make some key changes. So in Genesis 8 and 9 today, we're going to consider it under three headings: God restores, God regulates, and God redeems. God restores, God regulates, and God redeems. Now we pick up the story from where we left off last week. Noah and his family in Genesis 7:24 have been shut in the ark, and the waters, the Bible tells us, prevailed on the earth 150 days. Genesis 8 verse 1 says this: God remembered Noah, and God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. What was God doing here? God was bringing the judgment of flood to the end, and He was restoring the world. But do you know the extent of this restoration? Did you notice, as Christina read the passage for us today, that Genesis 8 and 9 actually mirrors the 6 days of creation in Genesis chapter 1? Did you notice that? You see, in Genesis chapter 1, on day 1 of creation, you had the earth, the deep, and the spirit hovering over the face of the earth. Now in the Hebrew, the word for spirit and the word for wind are the same word. So you had earth, you had the deep, and you had the spirit. Look at Genesis 8 verse 1 and 2. What do you have there? You have wind, you have earth, you have the deep again. It's a mirror. Now in Genesis 1, 7 and 8, on day 2 of creation, you had the waters and the sky. Look at Genesis 8 verse 2. You had the sky. Genesis 1 verse 9, on day 3, you had water and dry ground appearing. Look at Genesis 8 verse 3 to 5. You have water and the tops of the mountains appearing. Now the sun, moon and stars created on the fourth day don't need to be created again. So Genesis 8 skips day 4. But look then at Genesis 8, 7 and 8. You have a raven, a bird, who goes across the face of the ground. And that should remind you of Genesis 1 verse 20. On day 5, you had birds across the expanse of the earth. It's a mirror. And finally, in Genesis 1:24, on day 6, you had creatures, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals. And what do you have in Genesis 8:17? You have creatures, you have animals, and you have creatures that move along the ground. And don't forget Genesis 1:26, where you had man made in the image of God. Look at Genesis 9:6. God made man in his own image. Genesis 8 and 9 actually mirror Genesis 1. Now what does that tell us? If God's flood was an act of uncreation in judging the earth, this work of restoration is nothing short of a work of recreation. God doesn't just renovate the earth after the flood. God recreates it again. Did you notice also that God gives to Noah and his family and the animals the same command that he gives to Adam and Eve? Look at Genesis 8:17. It says, be fruitful and multiply. He says that again in Genesis 9:1. Be fruitful and multiply in Genesis 9:7. Be fruitful and multiply. Have we heard this language before? Of course, we've heard it in Genesis 1. In Genesis 1:28, when God gives humanity the mandate to take care of the earth, he says to them, be fruitful and multiply. What God is doing after the flood is recreating the earth, giving the earth a truly fresh start. He's not just renovating the world, he's recreating the world. This is a new Genesis 1. And friends, this is so good for us. Some of us think that we've just blown it in life. We've failed too badly, fallen too greatly, and we'll never be able to pick ourselves up again. Friends, know this. The God that you believe in is the God that can recreate the entire world. He's a God who has the power to recreate the entire world. And so as long as you are alive, if you trust in this God, you can indeed have a fresh start in your life. It may not be the kind of life that you expected. You may not be doing the kinds of things that you want to do, but God can rebuild your life. God can recreate your life and make it a life that is built on Him for His glory and for the good of others. The God that we worship is a God that can recreate the entire world. This is the power of God at work. He recreates, He restores the entire creation. Now there's something very sobering though that we need to note here. Even though God has dealt with the external wickedness and corruption on earth by wiping out the wicked through the flood, evil remains within the hearts of men and women. Come with me to Genesis 8 verse 20. And it tells us that after the ark rested, the waters subsided, Noah and his family get out of the ark. The first thing that Noah does is he builds an altar and he offers a sacrifice to the Lord. He thanks the Lord for preserving him and his family through the flood. And what does it say in Genesis 8:21? God receives that sacrifice and God says this, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for, or some translations have it, even though the intention of man's heart is evil from youth. Do you realize what he's saying here? Even though he has wiped out all the wicked people from the face of this earth, even though, as O. Palmer Robinson says, God has demonstrated an appropriate historical demonstration of the ultimate destiny of a world under sin, even though he has wiped out all this external evil, sin and evil runs so deep into the hearts of men and women that even a worldwide flood will not purge our hearts of evil and sin. Evil and sin remains within the hearts of the people even after the flood. You see, sin is man's declaration of independence from God, and it has changed the world in such a way that it is no longer like it used to be at creation. Even though God has dealt with the external wickedness, he has wiped it all away, the wickedness within the hearts of humanity remains. God has to do something more. God doesn't just need to restore the world and recreate the world. He needs to do something about the sin and the evil that remains in our hearts. And the next thing we see is that God in this world, after the flood, needs to regulate the earth. Come with me to Genesis 9 verse 1. Now Genesis 9 verse 1 and 4 parallels Genesis 1, 28 and 29. Why don't we just quickly turn there? Let's turn to Genesis 1, 28 and 29. And this is what God's word says in Genesis 1, verse 28 and 29. This is the original mandate that God gives to Adam and Eve. He says this: God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Genesis 1:29. And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food." Let's turn back now to Genesis 9 verse 1 to 4. Genesis 9, 1 to 4 parallels Genesis 1, 28 to 29 as God is recreating and restoring the earth. But Genesis 9, 1 to 4 has some very important changes to the original mandate in Genesis chapter 1. Firstly, look at Genesis 9 verse 2. It says this: "The fear and dread of you shall be upon every beast." The beast, the animals, will now fear and dread you, humans. That was completely absent from Genesis 1:28. Why does God put this in here? Why does God place a fear and dread of the animals against humanity? You see, because of the fall, when the world has been plunged into sin, animals are no longer living in harmony with you and I. They are hostile against humanity. And so what God is doing here in giving them a fear and dread is a way of constraining the animals from completely destroying the human family. What God is doing here is placing a constraint on the animals. Now, you know, it's often said that if there's a wild animal that comes along, you should just walk confidently and ignore it. Don't run, because the animal is more afraid of you than you are of it. It doesn't always work, right? Sometimes you still get torn to bits, right? So this is not a be-all, end-all here, saying, they're going to be fear you, so don't worry, just walk boldly into the lion's den. That's foolishness. But imagine that kind of a fear that animals have for humans was completely absent. Imagine walking into the Singapore Zoo and every animal in those enclosures is completely fearless. Every carnivore. What kind of a world would you and I live in? What God is doing here is placing a constraint on the animals so that humans are not completely ripped apart. Yes, once in a while, it happens. But overall, there is constraint. Fear and dread of the animals against humanity is placed to keep us safe. Secondly, God constrains people's use of animals. Now you notice in Genesis chapter 1 that God gives only plants as food to humans. But here in Genesis 9, He gives every animal as food to them. Now we're not told why, and neither do we need to think that consuming meat only happened at this point. Because remember in Genesis chapter 3, death was introduced into the world, and the first one to kill an animal was God Himself. In Genesis 3:21, He killed an animal and He used its skins to cover Adam and Eve. And remember again in Genesis 4, Abel was a keeper of sheep, and he had brought God fat portions of his flock as a sacrifice. So it does not mean that the consumption of meat only began at this point. So why then is God specifically saying, I am now sanctioning your use of animals as food? Now remember, the world that Noah had come from was filled with all manner of violence. Violence between humans and violence between humans and animals. Animal cruelty was a part of that violence too. So even though in 9 verse 3, God gives an official sanction to humanity to eat meat, 9:4 regulates that sanction. Look at 9 verse 4. It says this, you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. God is placing a constraint on our consumption of meat. Even as He has placed a constraint on the animal to protect us, He has placed a constraint on us to protect the animals. Now what does it mean here? Not to eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood in it. It means, firstly, not to eat an animal while it's still alive. Not to eat an animal while it's still alive. And the second thing it means here is to not eat the blood of the animal that represents its life and is sacred. Now, this became enshrined in the ceremonial laws of Israel. So, for example, in Leviticus 17, verse 12, it says, no one among you, God says to His people, shall eat blood, nor shall any stranger who dwells among you eat blood. And this, my friends, is the basis for the Jewish preparation of kosher meat. The blood is completely drained from the animal before it is fit for consumption. Now, do you know, right up to the first century, in the early church, when there were converts from Judaism and the Gentile converts living together, the apostles in Acts 15, 20 and 29 continue to tell the non-Jewish believers to abstain from eating blood in order not to unnecessarily stumble the Jewish converts. So this became part and parcel of the life of the Jewish people. They would not consume blood, and they had to go through the ritual of draining an animal of all of its blood before the meat was fit for consumption. But then Paul, later on in 1 Corinthians 10:25, says this, eat whatever is sold in the meat market. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market. And in that context, he's talking about the pagan meat markets. So at some point in time, we realize that this ceremonial law no longer applies to Christians. So if you like, or you can't eat it in Singapore because AVA has kind of banned pork blood and things like that. But if you like haggis in Scotland, or you know, you cross the border into Malaysia and you eat curry noodles or yong tau foo and a couple of cubes of blood, that isn't something that you need to avoid necessarily. Because in 1 Corinthians 10:25, God says, Paul says, eat whatever is sold in the meat market. So why? Why did God introduce this to the Jewish people? Why does He tell them, don't eat the blood? Not only that, drain the blood from the animal. It doesn't really do the animal any good, right? Dead already. So why does God say, drain the blood from the animal? Why does God say, refrain from eating the blood? It's an object lesson. Every time they eat meat, every time they drain the blood from the animal, every time they see the blood of the animal, they are reminded that the blood belongs to God. Life belongs to God. That God will demand an accounting for every life, even the life of an animal. So yes, humans, you can indeed have your steak, your chicken rice, your duck rice, but you cannot and you should not be cruel to animals. You can indeed kill the animals for food, but you must do so in a humane manner, because God keeps us accountable even for animal death. Animal life is important to God. Animal life is important to God. He places the constraints on the animals so that humans are not wiped out. But he places a constraint on humans so that the animals are not completely wiped out either. Life is precious to God, even animal life. And even for animal life, he will seek an accounting, a reckoning. And that's the argument of Genesis 9 verse 5. Because thirdly, God now places a constraint and regulates the sanctity of human life. He says here, Genesis 9 verse 5, for your lifeblood, speaking to Noah, for your lifeblood, for the lifeblood of men and women, I will require a reckoning, or I will require an accounting. From every beast I will require it, and from man. Genesis 9 verse 6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. If animal life is precious to God, what God is saying here is, human life is even more precious to God. And he demands an accounting for human life. And what he is doing here is putting in place regulations, putting in place a constraint. He is setting up a proportionate response to the taking of human life. Now remember Genesis 4:23 and 24, where Lamech kills a young boy merely for wounding him and insists that he be avenged 77-fold. That's the kind of world that Noah had lived in. A world of indiscriminate violence, a world of inordinate revenge. And what God was doing here was placing a constraint to confine vengeance. He was putting in place what became known as the principle of lex talionis, or an eye for an eye. Now some of us think that's quite violent of God, but actually that's very gracious of God. Without this principle of an eye for an eye, you wound me, I kill you. You kill one of my family members, I wipe out your entire generation. It's a world of chaos. It's a world of indiscriminate violence. And what God does here is, he places a constraint. He says, if a man's life is taken, the one who takes the life, I will demand an accounting. It's an eye for an eye. Now do you realize why? Why does he say human life is precious? Why does he say he will demand an accounting for every human life? It says in Genesis 9 verse 6, because God made man in his own image. God made man in his own image. And we know that's from Genesis chapter 1. The reason why human life is precious and human blood is precious is because humans are made to resemble God and to represent Him. Humans, by virtue of being made by God, are precious to God. And God takes everyone's life personally. God takes everyone's life personally. And He personally demands an accounting, a reckoning for the taking of every human life. Your life and my life. Do you realize what this says about your life? Do you realize what this says about the life of the people that you despise? says that they are precious to God. It says that they are worthy of respect and honor because they are made in the image of God. And God will take it personally. God takes every single life personally. So you've ever thought that your life is worthless? Or even if you've ever thought that my life is worth a lot because I've done so much for myself? This teaches us that the basis for your worth is in the fact, is in the reality that you and I are made in the image of God. So in this world that is recreated and restored, God regulates it because that is what sin regulates it, to constrain sin and to constrain evil. Now friends, some of us don't like rules and regulations. Some of us don't like procedures and processes. We think, oh, that's such a hassle. What's important is what's happening in my heart. What's happening in your heart, my friends, is evil, is sinful. Don't always trust what's going on in your heart, because what's happening in your heart may fool you. This side of the second coming, this side of Jesus Christ coming again, God puts in place rules and regulations and procedures to keep us safe, to constrain the evil that's in our hearts, to constrain the evil that's in society, so that some semblance of the society that He intended for us to have remains. That is why He's put in place processes and procedures, rules and regulations. Now, I've told this story before, but not everyone was here. But a few years ago, I went to a country, I won't name the country, where, you know, the traffic rules were just not obeyed. You know, so after 2 weeks in the country, I still couldn't figure out whether they were driving on the left side of the road or the right side of the road. Right? Because everyone would just place their vehicle where there was a convenient spot. And everyone would just honk and honk and honk. Now, in some sense, that particular country is freer, right? They don't have, or maybe they have, but they're just not obeyed. They've got rules and regulations, but they should not completely obey. Everyone does what is right in their own hearts. And you could say that in another country where rules and regulations are enforced, that's more restrictive and that's constraining and there's no freedom. But which one has freer flow of traffic? Which one has true freedom? The one where everyone does according to what they think is right in their own hearts, or the one where there are certain external constraints placed so that there can be true freedom. And what God does in a world infused with sin is He places rules and regulations, principles and procedures in order to make sure that life can go on. It is a work of His grace. And we ignore these rules and these regulations and these principles and these processes at our own peril. Don't always trust your own hearts, my friends. Because the Bible tells us our hearts are wicked. Our hearts tend toward evil. But the next thing that God does is that He redeems. God goes further than just regulating the earth. He also redeems the world. Do you notice multiple times that God says He will never again destroy the earth with a flood? He says in Genesis 8 verse 12, I will never again curse the ground because of man. In Genesis 9 verse 11, never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Genesis 9:15, the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. God promises that He will never again destroy the earth with a flood. And how does He make sure that this will happen? He seals it with a covenant. He seals it with a promise and a pledge that He makes with all of creation. Genesis 9, verse 9 to 11. Behold, God says, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as come out of the ark. It is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off. by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Do you see what's happening here? God is binding himself by promise to his creation that he will never again destroy the earth with a flood. He is binding himself. He is promising. He is pledging. I will sustain the earth. I will never again send a flood. And how does he guarantee this promise? He guarantees this promise by giving them a sign. A sign of the covenant. Genesis 9 verse 12 and 13. This is the sign of the covenant. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. You see, when God sees a rainbow in a cloud, it says in verse 16 that he will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between him and every living creature. Now, it does not mean that God invented the rainbow at this juncture. Rather, it means that he takes something that already existed and he sets it apart and he infuses it with a meaning and a purpose that he had never had before. So, my friends, the reflection, refraction, and dispersion of light in water droplets resulting in a spectrum of light appearing in the sky, the refraction of white light into red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, the rainbow, as you and I know it, that previously existed. God takes this common thing. He sets it apart. And he infuses it with a meaning and a purpose that it never had before. He infuses it and makes it a reminder to himself and to all creation that he has bound himself in covenant to never destroy the earth with a flood ever again. Next week we will be celebrating the Holy Communion. Now some of us think, hey, that's not really very important to me. It doesn't really work for me. In some ways, it's not whether it works for you, my friends. What really matters is what God has infused into the meaning of the bread and the wine. God has set apart common things, bread and wine. And he has said, these things now remind you of what I have done for you on the cross. And as you participate in that, you will remember and I will remember my covenant that I have established with you. It's not the value that we place on these external signs that matters. It's the value that God has placed on these external signs that make them so precious. So let's prepare our hearts to come and participate of the bread and wine in accordance with God's word and in accordance with the meaning that he has infused into them. Not what we think, but what God has said of these things. Now, do you know that the original word in the Hebrew here is not the word for rainbow? When he talks about God placing the bow in the skies, it's not the word for rainbow. It's actually the word for a warble. You know, bow and arrow. Dang. It's actually the bow, the warble. It's a weapon of war. It's not the usual word used for rainbow. So some commentators see the rainbow as a symbolic act of God putting down his weapon of war, promising not to use it again on the earth. So friends, when you see a rainbow in the clouds, you and I should also be moved to see what God has done for us. He is no longer at war with us. He has put down his warrior's bow. And he promises now to sustain us and to keep us, Genesis 8:22, while the earth remains. He has put his weapon of war against us down. But the question is, how can God do this? The world still deserves to be destroyed. We saw in Genesis 8:22 that the intention of man's heart continues to be evil from his youth. And if God is just, he must punish that. We see that it doesn't just remain in the heart, because in Genesis 9 verse 18 and 29, even Noah The one who was righteous, the one who was blameless, the one who walked with God, was nonetheless sinless. He gets out of the ark. He plants a vineyard. He makes some wine. He drinks that wine. He becomes stone cold drunk. And not only does he get drunk, he gets completely naked and he passes out. Now, friends, the Bible is just very honest, okay? It doesn't whitewash the heroes of the Bible. This is Noah, my friends. Naked, drunk, lying there. And it says that one of his sons, Ham, walks in on his naked father and mocks him, laughs at him, makes fun of him, and even comes out to cajole his other brothers to do the same. Now these two brothers, they're a bit more righteous. They refuse. So they go in, they close their eyes, they don't look at their father, they cover him, and they walk out. Now when Noah wakes up, he's angry, and he curses the descendants of Ham. No, he curses. He curses the descendants of Ham in a world that has just been rid of wickedness and of corruption. The curse remains in this world, my friends. How can God say to this world that continues to be worthy of judgment and destruction? How can He say to this world, how can He pledge Himself to never destroy it by flood again? How can He do that when it's so obvious that the world continues to deserve His punishment? Do you realize that God made this promise not to destroy the earth only after Noah has done something? Come with me to Genesis 8:20-21. It says, Noah built an altar. He took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again strike down every living creature. God says, I will never again strike down every living creature because Noah has first brought some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered it as a sacrifice of atonement before the Lord. So what Noah was doing here was, yes, he was thanking God for preserving them, but he was also functioning as a priest, offering an atonement. Every other creature, clean or unclean, gets to live because Noah has first offered some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird. It's a sacrifice of atonement. But of course, this sacrifice merely points forward to a greater sacrifice. Turn with me, won't you, to Hebrews 10 verse 4. And we close here. Hebrews 10 verse 4, the author of the Hebrews says this, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Hebrews 10 verse 3, it is merely a reminder, a picture. What we really need is Hebrews 10 verse 10. We have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. This sacrifice that Noah put forward as an atonement that God saw and said, I will never again strike because of this sacrifice. This was a sacrifice that pointed to a greater sacrifice, to the efficacious sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. You see, God can pledge that He will never destroy the earth and not count the sins of His people against Him because it has been reckoned. It has been accounted for. Lex talionis. By the shed blood of His own Son, Jesus Christ, who at Gethsemane was offered up as a clean sacrifice, as a sacrifice fully pleasing to God. God can lay down His bow of war against us because Christ has taken the arrow of his judgment on our behalf. So Christians, when you see that rainbow, you are reminded that God has taken the arrow of judgment for us. Friends, if we really want a fresh start in life, we need to anchor our lives in the hope, the joy, the satisfaction, the fulfillment, and the contentment of a God that does not count our sins against us, but has taken our judgment and has given us instead his pledge that I am for you and not against you. We need to get rid of the junk within before we can be joyful without. Let's pray.